have your attention, please?
You're listening to Tales from the Tannoy with Eleanor Hamilton.
Wherever we go, whatever we do, voices follow us around. They might be reading adverts on the TV, or they might be telling us which bus to catch. They might even be telling us that an unexpected item of shopping is in the bagging area. My voice announces trains on the London Underground.
This is Covent Garden.
And I'm heard by millions of people every year, but nobody knows or even needs to know my name. My husband, Phil Sayer, has the most famous announcement of all.
Mind the gap.
And we still work together every day, even though he died from esophageal cancer in 2016. Our story's told in episode one, but behind each voice we know so well lies a story. These voices are such an important part of our lives, but we don't usually know who they belong to. Today, I'm speaking to a voice who's heard every night across America.
Okay, so with Grey's Scandal and Murder, you have the total trifecta of twisty, tweetable drama all on one binge-worthy night. Super Sunday starts at 10 on Fox Sports 1. Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist premieres January 7th on NBC.
And most Brits will recognize her too, because she's heard on commercials worldwide. Her name is Anna Vecchino. But she's not just a voice. She's an actress and a stand-up comedian and even a low-carb cookery book writer. In fact, when I Googled her, the first thing that came up was not Anna Vecchino voiceover. What came up was Anna Vecchino blueberry muffins. Anna, do you want to tell me why this is? Because I know you've had a very complicated relationship with food over the years, and now you've turned it around and you've kind of made it your thing.
Yes, I was an on-camera actor first, and I've always been a comedian. And then I felt like voiceover was just easier because nobody's looking at me. I can just be in a dark room and do my thing. And yes, you get directed, but it wasn't as scary. I didn't feel as vulnerable as when I was on camera. So and I wound up doing several television series and guesting on a bunch of shows here in the States. But voiceover was really the thing that kind of took off. And I had a show canceled in 2009 that I really loved to pieces. And I went into a kind of a big depression about it, like a big, long, very bad depression. And depression runs in my family. My mother was hospitalized after I was born for 2 years.
Wow.
For depression. This is back when they would give you electroshock and lithium. And she stayed there for 2 years. And I floated around with family members. And my father left when I was 8 months old. I do have a relationship with him, but he left. And also, this is the early 70s. He couldn't get custody. So, you know, in the early 70s, even if the mother is hospitalized for mental illness,
still not gonna
the father
get it to the
still
bloke.
Couldn't get, yeah, not going to happen. So it was an interesting time. And by the way, all is well about all of this. But if it helps anybody else out there, I'm happy to tell the story. And here's another interesting thing. I've never actually heard my father's side of the story of this. So me telling this story is 100% my mother's perspective,
because
really? I was too young to remember. He is such a stoic Italian man who grew up, he didn't have a tub or a shower. His parents were from Italy. They were in like the poor side of town in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And he grew up like having to be so strong that he just doesn't have these conversations. And I'm like, I've forgiven everybody. So I don't need to, you know, but that being said, no wonder she's a comedian. Oh, no wonder she moved to Hollywood with that kind of damage. Hell
wow.
Yeah. But that's why we have therapists and, you know. Anyway.
And they're 10 a penny over there, aren't they? So, you know, if you're going to
exactly.
If you're gonna need a therapist,
exactly.
Then Hollywood is the place to be.
Hollywood's the place to be. Mm. Dial them up. They Skype. So in 2002, my mother was very, very ill and was having to go into the hospital every 3 weeks to get blood transfusions because her body wasn't manufacturing enough blood. She had all these crazy symptoms that didn't make any sense. And a girlfriend of mine at the time, she said to me, she has type 1 diabetes, and she said to me, I'm not eating gluten. And I was like, I don't know what that is. And I was like, well, that's crazy. But she told me about a couple of the symptoms. And I was like, huh, it sounds like kind of what my mom is dealing with. And so I called my mom, and she'd been tested for everything at this point, just poked and prodded 6 ways to Sunday. The bad news is if you like food at all, even a little bit, gluten's in a lot of stuff.
Yes.
All the fun things.
Yeah. I was going to say pizza, pie, everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Donuts, cakes, cookies. All the good stuff. And then she calls me and says, that's it. I have it. And it's hereditary. You have to get checked. So I'm 28 at the time. And I'm like, well, I don't have it. I'm an actress. Like I had been doing Atkins or like whatever, like low carb thing, but not really. And so I was like, I always watch my figure and I get tested for it. And boy, do I have it. And I just had certain symptoms that I lived with, asthma, respiratory infections all the time. So fine, whatever. cut out gluten, have the temper tantrum. And what had happened over the years is I had slowly started to put on weight. Well, good thing I work in voiceover. And then when things were slow, I was like, I'm going to blog gluten-free recipes. Because at the time in 2002, when I started going to Whole Foods or whatever Shishi Erewhon type of grocery store overpriced, I remember I bought this bag of chocolate chip cookies that were gluten-free, and they were $17.
Good God.
For a tiny bag of cookies. And I was like, well, I need these cookies.
Were they worth it?
They were the most disgusting piece of garbage, trash cookie. And I wish I could remember the brand, because I would call them out and say, fuck you. Fuck you, brand of disgusting $17 cookies. And I was like, we need alternatives. So I made it my free time life's mission to make all the delicious things. And I think, actually, I know that contributed to putting on weight. Because you can't eat baked goods with impunity, no. I've come to find out.
Damn it. Yeah.
Oh, let's go back to 15 years old. Part of the damage was I figured out I could control what I thought. I could control what was happening around me if I controlled what I ate, and I stopped eating for 2 years.
That is exactly what I did at exactly the same age. Yeah.
And how did it work out?
Not brilliantly well, actually.
It turns out you can't control your environs, the behavior of other people, or even your feelings.
No.
If you're not eating.
It's strange, isn't it? It's almost as if we need food. Who knew?
I know. So I come from that diet mentality. I was in ballet for 14 years. I was a pro at dieting. And so now, fast forward however many, 30 years, it's really easy for me to spot a fellow current dieter, a counter. Yeah. If I can work out in therapy all this damage and this insanity, then anybody can do it.
Yeah.
But I always said if I wrote a diet book called Hate Yourself Thin, and I swear I'm going to write this TED Talk and give it, Hate Yourself Thin, I would be a billionaire and you and I wouldn't be talking because I would be on a yacht avoiding what's happening in the world right now.
Yeah.
Hate Yourself Thin would sweep the nation. Yeah. It's really hard to function in this society where we have stuff coming at us right and left with healthy brains. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of us are dealing with depression. We're dealing with hormonal issues. We're dealing with families who aren't supportive. We're dealing with past trauma that's not been resolved or integrated into the body. And that messes with your brain. Then what happened in 2014, now my mom did give up the gluten in her diet and she would not eat real food. She became a sugar addict. You know, her teeth fell out. She started to put on weight. She started to get thyroid issues. She had kidney issues. She had kidney failure. This is where it gets really tricky as somebody who loves their family members. You always want to like help them. Hey, why don't you try this? Why don't you do this?
Yeah.
And she was not having it. And so she went in for a heart valve replacement in 2014.
Right.
With a crack team of surgeons at Johns Hopkins at Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, right across the street from the National Institute of Health. Like she couldn't have had a better place to go have the surgery done. And she did not wake up. And it was sort of a confluence of events that happened. And then she developed a MRSA infection and ultimately had died of sepsis. Never woke up. And I managed, thank God, was able to get there at the end, which, by the way, if you can be there for someone's death, I highly recommend it. I highly recommend being with people at the time of their passing. And I feel like we are far too sheltered about death.
Yes, I quite agree.
We need to be there. It needs to be part of the life experience that we have. Mm. It was obviously one of the hardest things I've ever done, probably the hardest thing I've ever done, and I've given birth with no drugs.
Well, you've got one on me.
One of the hardest things I've ever done. If I had my druthers, I would have had all the drugs. But there wasn't time for that. Anyway, so I just really think like from that experience, I was like, how are we sheltered from this? Why are we not a part of this? Why do we hide from it? We're all scared of it. That's why. But it's such an important thing to be there. However, for years after that, I really beat myself up for not, why didn't I force her into quitting the sugar?
Yeah.
And I had to make peace and forgive myself and go, you can't force somebody to eat a certain way.
No, you can't. And actually, it is part of somebody's being, especially if somebody's ill. They want to take control of it. And they will either say, okay, throw whatever you can at me. I'm willing to listen to anything. But then other people, and my husband did, become very protective of themselves and kind of go, yeah, hang on. I'm sick of people sticking needles in me, doing this to me, doing that to me. Mm-hmm. The one thing I want to be able to do is to control what I'm eating. And nobody can take that away from me. So it could have been that maybe she just didn't want that.
Well, there we go with the control thing, too. If I can control that, at least that's the one thing I can control. And it's very interesting how much I am fascinated by how much of our beliefs are tied into how we eat and our behaviors around food and how much, you know, food means joy to me. So when I or stress relief or boredom or, you know what I mean, like whatever. And if you're really sick and people are telling you what to eat, I completely understand the impulse to say, screw off. I'm going to do this my way. I'm tired of people bossing me around. And in fact, I relate to that so much because when I was 6 years old, my mom and I always had a very interesting relationship when she did get out of the hospital. And we, you know, she did a great job as a single mom, giving me all the opportunities she could possibly get for me. I have an education that somebody of my socioeconomic station should never have had. And that's all due to her. But she did say, when I was 6 years old, my favorite phrase was, "You're not the boss of me." And
you said that to her.
Oh, yeah. Constantly. I still say it to my husband all the time. I love that phrase because I have to assert my independence. And I guess that's the only child in me as well. I'm like, "You're not the boss of me." I came forth knowing what I want. He rolls his eyes, but she would make me write, I can't remember which commandment, "Thou shalt honor thy mother and thy father," fifth or sixth. She was a minister, by the way. She was a United Methodist minister. Yes. So so that's why I should know the commandment, but obviously I haven't been to church in many years. No. So there we go. I don't know. But "thou shalt honor thy mother and thy father." The King James translation, obviously. Not any newfangled English version.
No.
No. No. I was like, "Thy? But, what is thy?"
So she was a single mum.
Yes.
But still making you write out the commandments to say, honor thy father and them. Where was your dad at this point?
Well, he went to Alabama and he taught at a university at Auburn. And so he was down there. I had a relationship with him. It was in the custody agreement. I saw him three times a year. We have a relationship.
Yeah.
All is well.
Good.
Everything's fine with that. It's just, he could not handle her mental illness. So he bailed. He got out. And again, that's the kind of thing where it's like, do you forgive? Or do you keep acting out or keep harboring it or keep, you know? And for me, it was a lot easier to forgive him and forgive her for how everything went.
Yeah.
And then
God in your life now, if you were brought up by a Methodist minister, then you're going to have had some of those values ingrained in you. I've got a theory about religion anyway. I'm not religious, but I do think that God is actually your conscience. Because
I agree.
Yeah, I just think that as long as you can be true to yourself and be kind and do all the right things, basically, it doesn't matter which book it came out of. You know, all the religions teach the same thing, which is basically don't be a twat.
Right. And it's, do unto others. Hello.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that the one thing that we can do for ourselves more than anything is to learn to forgive. Because as soon as we've learned to forgive, that whole weight just comes off your shoulders.
It's amazing. And I do think there are certain gifts that come with turning 40. And I have so many comic friends who are in their late 30s right now. And I'm loving watching them just completely torture themselves. And I keep telling them, I'm like, "You guys, I get it. You're going to do it no matter what I say. But when you turn 40, all of a sudden, like literally that day, a weight is lifted."
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is.
And it's because you just can't continue to mess around with the foibles of youth anymore. Mm. You've got to deal with your shit.
Yeah.
And then a weight is lifted. You're like, I've been the one choosing to carry that around this whole time. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Great. Bye. I'm ready to let it go. And it's really quite wonderful. And then it keeps developing. You know, my mom, I was 41 when she passed away. And it's been an interesting thing because when I will tell, and anybody who can listen, if you have any issues with living family members, I would highly advise for you to put on your big girl pants and deal with them while they're living, because it's a lot easier than once they pass and you have unresolved stuff. However, it can still be done. You can still resolve it and you still can work through it. But it is interesting, because if I kept her in this place and only talked about certain things, that would be the key to us having a functional relationship, you know? And turns out, once she passed, I was like, damn it, why didn't I bring that up, you know? But, you know, that's how you learn.
Of course.
And that's all okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was hard. I didn't want to force my quote unquote sugar-free agenda. I wanted to like lay it out there. She wasn't interested. And now, having seen, you know, yes, voiceover is my day job. And it's such a cool day job. I'm the voice of NBC. I am the voice of a bajillion other things. And it's awesome. And I love it. But this cookbook thing has taught me a lot more about human nature, because I'm out there and I choose to be out there in the weeds, in the thick of things. I have witnessed all sorts of crazy human behavior that is ultimately driven by the food and the weight issues.
Yeah.
And or people like, the number one question I get asked is, I just started this a month ago. I feel great. I've dropped, you know, whatever, 18 pounds. But my husband, my wife, my whatever, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, they don't want to do it. They think I'm crazy. I'm eating steak, you know. And so how do I handle it? And I always say, live by example. Look at us. We're being religious again. Another religious tenet. Live by example. But it's true, because when people are ready, they'll look for answers. We've all been in that place of where we've Googled late at night, like, I want to lose weight, or I want to do this, or I want to do that. So whatever's heavy on our heart. How do I make my marriage better? We've all Googled those things late at night, you know? So eventually they'll either ask you or they'll just start eating what you eat. And kids, I was the mom, by the way, who made three different meals for years. One for me, one for my husband, one for my kid. I don't recommend that.
No, it's the one thing I didn't want to get into ever. When I was going through my cancer treatment, I basically was on the floor because my husband had died maybe 6 months before that.
It's so crazy what you went through. It's so crazy.
Yeah, but I remember thinking, oh God, you know, anything for a quiet life. And I think that lots of mums do this, especially when they're on their own.
Yeah.
You know, they haven't got the energy to, because it's just exhausting being a mother.
It's exhausting.
And kids are just such dicks half the time.
Yeah.
Well, actually, most of the time.
Oh, yeah.
So you just end up doing whatever you can. And it's taken me probably three years or so to unpick all that damage that was done. And it was all done in the best of faith, really. It was just one of those things I had to get through. Every day was kind of like, right, wake up, get this day over, go to bed, start again. It's really hard. And I think that it's a bizarre thing how we get so obsessed with it. Because I know that when I was a teenager, that was my thing that I could control. And like you, I love food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of my favorite things in the world.
It was such a crazy, like, it's like, hello?
Yeah.
Why are you depriving yourself of one of the things that you love the most?
So why do you think that you did choose food, and how did you manage to quit by eating?
Well, part of it was, again, exposure to doing ballet for so many years. You get the messaging constantly about you have to look a certain way. And when I hit puberty, I got hips and a butt and boobs, and it didn't sprout up tall like the other girls.
You're Italian, so.
And I'm Italian. Hello.
Hello.
Oh my God. I've got it coming at me. I've got tits and ass coming at me from all directions. So, and it's now much more accepted to have dancers of all different body types, which is awesome. And I love it. But usually it's the prototype of, 5'8", 5'9", 5'10" dancer with the very thin, very hardly any boobs, no hips, very, very lithe. And don't get me wrong, that's a beautiful body type. And I love watching dancers. I'm trying to get my Instagram explore page to just be puppies and ballerinas. Like I don't want to see anything else. Just puppies and ballerinas. Just the things that make me happy. Maybe some landscapes from time.
Yeah.
Maybe if somebody goes a pretty place. So exposure to ballet made it very easy to just kind of hone in on that and just be like, oh, well, I can just be thin. That's an easy thing to be.
But was there anything that happened in your teenage years that made you, because you said it was 2 years that you didn't eat for, and obviously the anorexia kind of can go on and on and on, really. But
I think it was sometimes the traumas of younger years can kind of all come to a head when you're a teenager and you're hormonal and everything kind of comes to a boiling point. And there was a lot of bullying at my middle school. And for 3 years, I was suicidal. I did not want to be there. I was hated by everybody in the school. It was a very small school. One of those schools where you have 12 kids in your class or 8 kids. And it was a very tricky time. And so the way I figured out how to start managing my pain, because I didn't want to tell my mother, because, you know what moms do? They want to call attention to it. And I didn't want, you know what I mean? As a middle schooler, you're like, oh my God, I'll just die if the other moms know or if the principal knows. You know what I mean?
Oh God, yeah.
And two of the coping mechanisms I came out of that with were be really funny, because I've noticed people will keep you around if you're funny.
Yes.
And they won't beat you up or throw or rally people against you. Be really funny. And internally, I could control the way that I ate. It's really hard to explain. You get it. It's really hard to explain it to somebody who doesn't get it and never went through that. But there's just something about if I don't eat, then I somehow am controlling how I feel. That's something that I have control over, so I can feel good about that.
Yeah. And you feel so good about yourself when you run your hands over that flat tummy that's just, yeah.
Or the hip bones popping out, or like, yeah, it was sick. It's very sick. But here's the thing. We do get this messaging, and I very much was a product of, you know, America in the late 80s, of reading 17 magazine and reading the things and saying, like, I want to look like her and I want to do this. And you're taught to diet and then the ballet in person. And I was very much that product of, like, I think I started my first diet when I was 8.
Wow.
I was 8 years old. I was like, I need to go on a diet. And did you ever watch Mad Men? January Jones, who plays the lead character's wife, is very weight conscious. And it reminded me of that's how everyone's moms kind of were back then. They would make a crack. They would make a crack at your weight constantly.
Yes, they would.
If there was something going on, or you should get a nose job, or you should, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
it was very much accepted. I wouldn't dream of telling my daughter, or even actually really even thinking it. Like, I don't know. It's very strange. Like, because we were taught at an early age that your weight was important, your looks are important, how are you going to get a man? So at the same time that she was teaching me, you need to get an education, because it didn't work out so well for her with her marriage, and she was very educated. But I hope that young girls now are getting some different messages of empowerment.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think I worry for our kids. I mean, we mainly have boys. We've got a 15-year-old daughter. That's my other half's girl. And yeah. I do worry particularly about her more than anybody, really, because I just think they're thrown so many images and they're given so much to deal with on Instagram. And every single picture that they see is edited or Photoshopped whatever.
I wish they could know how fake it all is.
I know.
I hear stories of influencers, and I use that term with a hint of derision in my voice. Influencers renting private jets so they can take a picture and stuff like that. And I'm like, I want to tell all the kids in the world, it's fake, it's fake, it's fake.
Totally fake. When I had my mastectomy, whenever it was, maybe 2-3 years ago, I made it happen that my kids saw me naked, even though they probably didn't really want to, you know.
Right.
I sort of make myself appear on the landing like, oh no, my towel's fallen off. Because I just think it's so important for especially teenage boys to see that a woman doesn't look like they look on Pornhub or whatever shit they're able to access on their phones. Women look normal. Women have bumps and lumps, and I just want them to get married to a woman or a man or whoever that is normal looking and has all the things wrong with them that you know, we all do.
That we all do.
Yeah.
What I found fascinating, when my daughter was born, she was born with a little cellulite on her bum.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, look at that.
Is that even allowed in LA?
No, we had to ship her off. She had to be raised elsewhere. Yeah, I was like, oh, see, well, sorry, kiddo. Got that from my side of the family, by the way. That's like the only trait of mine. She looks exactly like my husband, except for like the cellulite on the butt.
Oh, well, you know, she's yours then.
Yeah, exactly.
She didn't get swapped to the hospital. Oh, bless her. Did you find it easy to be a mum, given that you'd had a fairly shaky start with your own mum?
I mean, I found it easy to fall in love with my child. Like it was really easy to do that. I don't know that my mom was able to fall in love with her child. I knew she loved me, but she had such bad postpartum depression. I think there was a cycle of abuse that stopped with me, and to some extent with my mom. There were some rough incidents early on, but I think that, like, it was a very, but also too, it was of the time. Like, I would get my butt spanked.
Yes.
If I did, you know what I mean? Yeah. It was just part of how you disciplined a child. And it was very like, come over here, bend over the knee, pull your pants down, thwack on the butt several times.
Yeah.
Like hard spanks on the butt. Like it's so weird.
I know you can't imagine doing it to a child now, but.
No, I can't imagine. Maybe that's the dissociative parts of our brains that we're like, isn't that weird that we did that? Anyway, trauma. You know, the things that I found hard were that my daughter, when she was a baby and a toddler, she was just a lot. And she didn't sleep through the night. She was 2.5. She had seizures. So stuff like that was really hard that I was like, oh my God, this is insane. That my husband and I, there were two of us and we felt outnumbered. Now, my husband and I, we got together and we did fall in love, but we hadn't been dating that long before I got pregnant. And so we decided to being the two good Italian people that we are, we decided to immediately get married because our parents told us to.
Yep.
And have our baby. And we do we now do a dual stand-up act about marriage and about, because we've been now married 21 years.
Yeah, that's great.
So we are actually healed a lot about our relationship through writing jokes about that. And we figure if we can embarrass ourselves on stage, it'll help. It helps other people feel better about their relationships. But no, I mean, we were knocked up one night doing ecstasy in the 90s. You know, like that's how it happened. Then all of a sudden it was like, boom, you're going to be parents at the age of 26. And that's not necessarily the best idea. So I was kind of like, I had been through a lot by the age of 26. So I was like, okay, let's get it together and let's be the best mom you possibly can. And then I remember when she turned about 7 or 8, I turned to my husband. And I was like, I think now, like all of a sudden I had that impulse of like, oh, I think I'm ready to be a mom now. And he's like, okay, well, that ship has sailed. Like, well, first of all, we're not having another one. Second of all,
well, I don't think I'm ready yet. And mine are going to be 15 next week. So,
right. Yeah. There you go. Happy birthday.
Thanks.
We did this thing where I was so upset taking her to New York that, you know, and my husband and I mean, voiceover, I can work from anywhere. He's a comedy writer. He can work from anywhere. We basically dropped her off at college and then we just stayed.
Oh.
We stayed for like a month and she was horrified. Now, we're in New York City, so it's not like we're like in her. We were like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But she, it's an interesting transition that I feel like is not talked about enough.
No.
The empty nest syndrome and just how like basically from 13 onward, you're just kicked to the curb. You're kicked in the teeth for 13 through 18. Then they go to university and your heart is ripped out after being abused for years by a teenager. Like you think like, okay, and there's a reason obviously that they do that. They're supposed to soil the nest so that they leave. You want them to leave. They need to leave. You've served your purpose. It's time to step out, but it's the most painful thing to go, okay, I guess if I'm doing it right, I'm supposed to feel a tremendous sense of grief.
Yeah. I guess you are. Yeah. I've not heard that phrase, soil the nest, but that makes an awful lot of sense. And of course, I've got teenagers in stereo at the moment because they're twins.
Oh,
And they're a complete pain in the ass. And I'm kind of counting the days for them to leave home, but I'm fairly sure that when they do, I'll be quite miserable about it.
You'll be
for at least half devastated. An hour, and I think.
For at least half an hour, and then you'll be like, wait a minute, I am free. Yeah, I know, that does pass. Let me be clear. It does pass.
Good.
But it is a rite of passage that I feel like isn't spoken of a lot. But it is tricky. We stayed for a month and it horrified her life. You know what I mean? We're like, hey, when you want to have dinner? She's like, never. I never want to have dinner with you. Never. But when? How about Thursday?
Oh,
it's horrifying and terrifying and you're scared for their life, but you have to do it.
I'm far more scared that they'll stay at home forever.
No, they'll get out.
I'll just change the locks when they turn 18 and not tell them.
You could do. That's another approach.
Are you enjoying being empty nesters?
We are enjoying it. And we were touring around the country doing our stand-up, but that's not happening right now. So we're not quite sure what the future holds for comedy, but hopefully we'll get back at the game. And also, that's a great reason to go to New York. We do shows there. No, our daughter is not allowed to see our stand-up.
Of course not.
Nor does she want to. We have good boundaries that way. She is going to be finishing school. We just got a house 2 hours north of L.A., so we're actually going to be moving out of L.A. very shortly. And
does your daughter know?
Living our life. Yes. She knows. We told her the forwarding address. And God, isn't that like a nightmare of a kid? Like you come home and your parents have moved behind your back. You don't know what. That was like a recurring nightmare that I had. That'd be so awful. I will continue doing voiceover for as long as the people will continue hiring me. I will continue writing recipes. I have two cookbooks out, Eat Happy and Eat Happy 2, which, by the way, they're named Eat Happy and Eat Happy 2 because I literally changed my brain chemistry, which I mentioned earlier.
Wow.
And also I have my mom correcting my grammar in my head. It's Eat Happily, darling. It's Eat Happily. Not Eat Happy. So I have a grammatically incorrectly titled book.
Just to annoy your mother.
Just to annoy her.
Great.
I'll still do that from time to time. I know when I annoy her. She kind of pings me.
Yeah.
From the great beyond. When I know when I've annoyed her, she tells me.
Good.
Yeah, I know. I like it.
You've been listening to Tales from the Tannoy with Eleanor Hamilton and Anna Vicino, with music from Beat Bakery. This podcast was produced by Carl Svensson from Tadar Media.